The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Today, international friendlies. Germany playing Italy in Dortmund. Lampard and co. unsettled by a fellow named Eriksson making passes. It's like 2006 all over again. We round up Denmark, England and the rest of the midweek action, like Scotland's big win over Northern Ireland, France, Brazil and the much-hyped Argentina, Portugal. Just what the world needs, another messy Chris Ronaldo showdown. There's your post and our big look forward to the Premier League weekend. Manchester derby ahoy. United City and a Manchester that's anything but. Plus, as West Ham visit West Brom in the big battle at the bottom, we ask how do Hammer fans feel about their stadium victory and will a running track be perfect for a team used to going round in circles? All of that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello everybody, welcome to this Thursday's pod. With us today, Paul McKinnon is. Hi Paul.
Hiya.
Hi. Raphael Honigstein's made the journey in. Good to see you, Raphael.
I was first choice.
So. You certainly were. And Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
Similarly, first name on the team sheet, apart from the other ones that were there. Yeah. Good. Nice to see you all. Tradition demands that we begin with England's 2-1 victory in Denmark. Paul McKinnon, you're just back from the disco.
Yeah, I was just doing the Terry Butcher dance.
Yep. Okay.
Because happy days are here again.
Are you happy?
I did get happy watching the football. Mm-hmm. And then I had to catch myself because when we had that disgrace.
You've been hurt before, haven't you?
Yeah. And I pledged that I would never get excited until we played well against a team of equal or higher standing in a knockout game in the World Cup.
Right.
So.
All right then. But there were many positive points.
Yeah, I thought. Well, not just for England, for Denmark as well. There was two youngsters stood out, and Jack Wilshere and Christian Eriksen. I thought they're just both really good examples of players who have an innate ability rather than have been coached to play a certain way. I think Jack Wilshere, when he was on the ball, he actually just wanted the ball all the time, which is something, you know, was quite original for an England player, not to be running away and hiding from it. And when he got it, he just wanted to pass and move and get England moving forwards. He's playing in a deeper role, but I can see him playing a bit further forward in years to come.
And Eriksen?
I think he's younger than Wilshere. He's actually only 18 still at the moment. And he played in a more advanced position, so he was kind of up against Wilshere, well, for the first half when Wilshere was on. His touch was first class, and he got the ball down. And, I mean, the ball he played in for Agger for the first goal for Denmark was a superb cross. And I can understand why a lot of teams are interested in buying him, but maybe for him at this moment in time to be at Ajax could be the best thing for him for another 2 or 3 years. It'd be a shame if he went somewhere else and just sat on the bench because he's a great talent, which is nice to see.
What about Rooney and Bent up front? How did that work?
Rooney still looked a little... He's got that kind of Fernando Torres disease. And he looked a little bit off his game, I thought. But he was involved in the build-up to the equaliser. He pinged a crossfield pass, which just narrowly evaded the head of the fullback.
It was a good ball, though, wasn't it?
It was good. It was a good ball. I think it almost got cut out, though. It was one of those things.
It should have been cut out, shouldn't it, really? You looked at it.
He's not quite at that level. And you would have thought it's not to do with his fitness now. There's something else. But he played all right. I thought Bent played pretty well.
Right.
There were a couple of loose touches. And, there was that header that got smothered by the keeper and he had another half chance.
But Ashley Young coming on for Rooney, did that look a bit more lively or not?
Well, he looked lively. I mean, to be honest, my main conclusion from watching that game was we had a lot of players on the pitch, both halves, who looked technically capable. Even to Glenn Johnson, in the second half, he was kind of took on three players and a little wrong, got broken down. There was lots of people who could control the ball and had a good touch. And they were all, 25 or under. Mm. I think it boded quite well. And then I thought, oh, no, don't do that, Paul.
One other thing, Scott Parker, a lot of attention on Jack Wilshere, but Ollie B saying Scott Parker looked very impressive. This will all be overshadowed by Jack Wilshere, but Parker played the role better than either he or Barry did.
Well, he was playing a little bit further forward, Scott Parker.
Yeah, he did very well, but I think he's not the future, unfortunately, anymore. Maybe had he not made the unwise decision to go to Chelsea all those years ago, which kind of put his career in a stasis or something, maybe it'd be something we could look forward to if he was like 23 now, but he's not. So, I mean, it's nice to see somebody like him, in the team, though.
Can I say a good thing about Theo Walcott? Mm-hmm. I like Theo Walcott quite a lot. I thought his involvement in the equalising goal was really good.
While getting his eye gouged as well.
While getting his eye gouged, really strong play up against the fullback, little step over. And then I know there's kind of a lot of use of this word instinctive and what it means or not, but, you know, kind of blind, with very little time to think, plays the ball right across the goal to where Bent is standing, goal. That for me, it's been coached, I'm sure, rather than something he kind of knew about when he was in the cradle.
But, Zatoichi? Huh? Is it Zatoichi? You'd know this, right?
Well, he's the blind samurai.
That's
from the
one.
Kurosawa film, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there were positive notes as well for Scotland, of course, midweek. A 3-0 win for them over Northern Ireland. Joining us from a noisy hotel in Dublin is Ewan Murray. Ewan, hello.
Afternoon, James. How are you?
Afternoon to you. Any sign of Kylie Minogue and Michael Hutchence there at all?
Not yet.
All
no,
right, then.
I've got my eyes
Keep
peeled.
Your eyes peeled. One of my favourite expressions, that one. Excellent. Now, Scotland. How about that 3-0 win over Northern Ireland?
Samba stuff from the Scots.
Yes, was it?
It's one of these strange games, James. Scotland played very well. The best they've played since Craig Levein took the job. But, you know, we have to acknowledge that Northern Ireland were really poor. Northern Ireland were also missing, I think, 10 players.
Yes.
So, I mean, when you looked at it, it was one of these, when you looked at the teams that started the game, you thought Scotland should win this game quite comfortably. But they did, and if you look back at Craig Levein's tenure, they've struggled so badly against teams like Liechtenstein. So for them actually to go out and play as well as they played will give the manager and the fans a lot of confidence.
Was there any reason why they played in a more assured fashion this time?
It just seemed a night where everything came together, everything clicked. Phil Bardsley, who's been a terrific find for Scotland, I know he's excelled at left-back for Sunderland, he was outstanding. Charlie Adam, as we know, had a great time at Blackpool, he was terrific as well. Kenny Miller led the line brilliantly. You know, I don't want to overdose on superlatives here, but it just seemed a night where everything fell into place. It may not happen again.
No.
And it would be typical Scotland that it happens in a friendly game.
No, let's not say that. What about the other 3-0, the Ireland's victory over Wales? Did you see that one as well?
That was a pretty flat game. Last night, was the Scotland game was more of a tempo to it. A very tame first half. In the second half, Wales just collapsed. I don't see too much of Wales, obviously, but for Gary Speed, it must have been worrying. They were disjointed, no creativity at all. They fell apart at the back. Ireland were okay, but weren't. I wouldn't say they were particularly good, but they still, you know, they swept Wales aside pretty easily.
Right. Of course, we often hear glum tidings from you, but at the moment, it must be a real air of optimism in the Scottish game, the national team doing well, and some big names as well joining the SPL, like Chris Commons and, of course, El Hadj Diouf.
Yeah, Mr. Diouf has been an interesting one for the media, obviously. That's going to be a story. To be fair to him, he played very well in the Old Firm game last week, which was also talking about, you know, positive sentiment. The Old Firm game on Sunday was a really good game. Diouf played well, got a fair bit of stick, as you would expect. Didn't react to any of it. Chris Commons, who scored again for Scotland last night, has had a really good start at Celtic as well. So, there's positive notes for now.
All right, well, let's finish there then before anybody starts smiling and that kind of thing. Ewan, thank you so much for joining us and enjoy the rest of the Celtic Cup.
No problem. Speak soon.
Ewan Murray in Dublin. In other glamorous midweek friendly news, France had a big 1-0 win over the Brazilians in Paris, a game which, of course, featured a rather cheeky chest-high tackle from Brazilian midfielder Hernanes. What did you make of it? Rafael, you saw this. What did you make of
Hernanes, yeah.
He's been really vilified for that, but I think he just wasn't looking where he was sticking his foot.
No? Ah, come on.
No. All right, then.
This was Nigel de Jong's defence at the World Cup. Well, there is no reason to put your foot there, even if you're not looking.
Ah. That's not
how you go for the ball. So
where did he put his foot, by the way? I'm
shoulder guessing. Height into the shoulder of who was it?
No, it was more sort of the solar plexus.
Benzema. He had a good game anyway, Benzema, didn't he?
Benzema did have a good game, although, you know, Brazil had one man down and they're not the greatest team in the world in defending this type of situation. They're good with the ball, and I think this new Brazil are not as sturdy as the Brazil we saw at the World Cup, who really were undone by sort of a free game, in my view. But the French were good. Benzema missed a lot of chances, but he looked very, very mobile and really up for it. And he had that hunger and that sharpness that we used to see from him before he made that move, when he was seen as the most exciting young striker in Europe. He seems to have that back.
Is that because he's playing more regularly for Madrid now?
Well, I'm sure it can't hurt. I think any striker has to play regularly, because you rely on maximising the very few touches, relatively speaking, that you get compared to the rest of your team. I think a striker only touches the ball 40, 50 times in a game, whereas the best midfielder or the left back, whatever, would touch it three times as much. So if you don't do that a lot, then you just kind of lose your confidence. And
the French certainly getting very confident about their chances. Better and better was the headline all over the L'Equipe today.
They always had a great team.
Yeah.
You know, even at the World Cup, you look at a team, you look at the names, they should have gone to the semi-final. They had the easy route. They went where Uruguay went with a crap team, in my view.
Mm.
Only because they took France's route.
Crap's a bit strong, but yeah. Jeremy Menez also looking very impressive in the build-up to the Benzema goal on the year. In other news, Spain beat Colombia 1-0. Switzerland had a goalless draw with Malta. They missed two penalties, the Swiss. Well done to the Maltese. It's a big result for them. Huh? And did we all see Wesley Sneijder's goal for Holland against Austria?
Oh la la.
Oof.
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 Very nice.
A variety of exhaled noises there, because it was a thraker, wasn't it?
It was, but it was also kind of just graceful as well. It kind of had power, but it had geometry.
But the build-up to it was amazing as well. It was like a pinball getting knocked around, and then it just flew up, and he whacked it home. Like, you know, great, great goal.
If you like that kind of goal,
yes,
go to YouTube and look for Gerd Müller's goal against Atletico Madrid in the 74 European Cup final.
Top tip.
Very nice. Mm.
I noticed when I was watching it on a probably illegal place, it was described as a golazo. Is that now commonly used to describe a good goal?
I think there might be an element of confusion here, because golazo in Portuguese would mean a wonder goal. Golazo, I don't know really if it actually means anything. Golacho would mean actually not a very good goal at all. It's kind of scuffed over the line.
So a golazo is Portuguese, described...
No, golazo is, golazo is what Steve DeBerry, who made the music for Football Italia years ago... If this word exists, I hold my hands up, it might mean that's a wonderful strike by a brilliant creative midfielder from the Dutch school. But I know that the golazo from the theme tune to Football Italia was Steve DeBerry thinking, ooh, that sounds a bit Latin, I'll chuck that
fantastic.
In.
No. Yeah. Fantastic.
So he was essentially going, go.
That was him
nonsense.
Going, golazo. It wasn't anybody actually kind of... Yeah, and a lot of people thought it was golazo, and I always said, no, clearly it's not, because we can't back any particular team. Until years later, I saw an interview with him saying, well, Paul Gascoigne was playing for Lazio, so I went, golazo.
Etymology Weekly.
That's it for part one, listeners. A sizzling part two awaits. Now, Raphael, among the many treats this midweek was the rematch of the 2006 World Cup semi-final at the Westfalenstadion.
That's the real name, yeah, but I think we're contractually obliged to call it the Signal Iduna Park.
Oh, right, okay.
Signal Iduna anytime.
Better and better. Now, the Italians are very happy about this 1-1 draw. Bella Italia, they said. Yeah, nice. And this is how we like you inside.
Mm.
Because Italy, they went a goal down against the Germans. And from the Italian perspective, they're quite excited about the fact that they didn't panic. They didn't let their heads drop. They didn't start hoofing the ball aimlessly at anybody who looked like they might be in a blue jersey up near the goal. They actually continued playing reasonably well, in the end got the equaliser and preserve their unbeaten status against the Germans. That goes back to what, 1995?
1995.
They're a real
friendlies.
Bogey team, aren't they?
That was in the friendly, and they've never beaten them in a tournament, ever.
Oof.
Yeah, so it was billed as a rematch, and the sort of narrative before the game was that here's the new Germany versus the still old and in decline Italy, and now it's time to sort of settle the score and... And of course, I think the Italians themselves seem to believe it to a certain extent, because Prandelli afterwards came out and said, we are not quite at Germany's level yet, but we're getting there, and this was the best performance of my reign. I think it was a system also that they played a 4-3-1-2 that, of course, has limitations as far as width is concerned. But if you have very intelligent and mobile frontmen who go wide, it can work
like
very
Maori,
well.
Like Maori, for example.
Yeah, well, Maori was starting in the hole but was going all over the place. And the Germans found it very difficult to pick them up. Likewise, it must be said, Thiago Motta in the holding position, his debut, wasn't really very good at all.
You didn't like him?
I think the problem really was that he had Montolivo and De Rossi quite close to him. But at times, the three of them just looked at each other and they weren't quite sure what to do with people like Özil, who were just sort of drifting all over the place. And
brilliant first goal anyway from the
it was Germans. An amazing first goal, really really great goal, the wonderful move, 1-2 Müller, Özil, Özil wasn't picked up properly, Müller wasn't picked up properly, and then he played in Klose, who is now on course of overtaking Gerd Müller soon in the all-time scorer list. So it's this guy's just remarkable.
Prandelli as well was saying they should have had two penalties. Jogi Löw, his opposite number, saying the Italians were very good, especially at falling over. What was your view?
Both these statements are correct. I think the Italians are very, very good at falling over, but they should have had two penalties. Mertesacker bundled over Cassano. That was a clear penalty. And just before that, he ran into De Rossi and kind of just pole-axed him. It looked like an accident, but I think I would have given a penalty.
So all in all, a disappointing evening for the Germans.
Not really, because you know, they were leading till 9 minutes from time. And of course, after the 60th minute, all the substitutions really changed the structure of the game completely. You could say that the real game had stopped by then. And of course, Italy still looked very, very dangerous, could have even won it in the end. And the result will disappoint them. But I think the performance was good, and especially the way that Özil played. I think he's grown even more as a player, and it looks better than he did in the summer. So that's a huge, huge encouragement.
Do we think these are mega friendlies that mean that the teams take the games more seriously?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, if you play good opposition, you want to win. And I think that's how friendlies should be. I mean, traditionally, I seem to remember in the 80s, whatever, the friendlies were kind of big deals because they're one of the few times where you'd meet big teams. You wouldn't wait 2-3 years to see these players. And of course, international club football wasn't as prominent, so you wouldn't see these players regularly. So it was a big thing to come up against.
Is it could become like autumn internationals in rugby or something? You know, you regularly get them in the calendar. It's something for people to look forward to. Keeps the kind of international teams in the frame. I liked Mega Wednesday.
I liked Mega Wednesday too. It was nice the way the teams really took that one seriously. And I don't know if you saw any of the Argentina Portugal game, but a cracking atmosphere in Switzerland. For that was Geneva. Yeah, very much the home of football. A great atmosphere and a proper match too.
Geneva's full of Portuguese people.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it?
There's a huge Portuguese XR community.
One person who did watch the Argentina-Portugal game was Marcela Moreira-Rajo, who joins us today now to tell us what she made of it. Marcela, much excitement over this victory?
I think there was, yes. It was very hyped before the game as a kind of big Messi versus Ronaldo extravaganza, and today's headlines in Argentina are already talking about Messi King. The manager Batista said he thinks they're both great players, but Messi was that little bit better last night. And yes, I think it was, put it this way, if Argentina had not won, then perhaps more questions would have been asked, it would have been more probing. But I think it's regarded as a great kind of confirmation that Messi is the best.
Am I right in saying that the team is more built around the little Argentine Leo Lionel than it was, say, at the World Cup under Maradona? And if so, was yesterday's, by all accounts, stellar performance the fruit of that?
I think you're absolutely right in saying the team is built around him more, and I think that's not by accident. I think Messi is an incredibly influential and powerful figure in Argentinian football at the moment, and there was a great sense that because he hadn't thrived under Maradona, it was important to find a manager or appoint a manager that would take this into account. It's so important that Messi feels comfortable, plays comfortable, and in fact, the post-match pressers already kind of have the quote, "I felt comfortable like I do in Barcelona," which seems to be the kind of truth we're seeking.
Well, he looked brilliant anyway. The pass he put through for Di Maria for the first goal was an absolute cracker. A lot made of the fact that Tevez wasn't playing because he'd missed the last game to be with his daughters or something or other.
I don't know if it's my old age or what, but I am beginning to kind of see the little tensions and the internal disputes over and above everything. I think what happened during the World Cup was that Tevez was quite outspokenly pro-Maradona. There was some tensions, perhaps. You know, a lot of people feel that in order to accommodate Tevez, Messi was played a little bit out of position. And after Maradona was dethroned and Batista took charge, Tevez made a great big hoo-ha about this. And he kind of appeared in a training ground, even though he wasn't going to play, made quite, you know, outspoken statements to the press. And at the time, it felt like, would he get away with it? Would he not? Now, it seems not. At the moment, Batista said last month something about Tevez needs to work out his personal troubles before he can truly kind of contribute to Argentina. And then yesterday, and in the previous days, there's been some quotes from the FA chairman saying, oh, well, Tevez missed the game in Qatar. Now, I think Tevez is clearly unhappy generally. We don't know what's going to happen. But it seems in this plan of making a team that functions around a Messi, it's harder to see where Tevez sits in.
All right, then. Marcela, brilliant stuff. Thank you very much for that. Look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Marcela Moreira-Rajo. Let's hear from Raphael Honigstein on the subject of poor old Steve McLaren, who's only been booted out of Germany by the nasty folk at Wolfsburg.
Mm.
Why, Rafa, why?
Why? Because the results were pretty poor.
Were they? Yes.
Won 5 games out of 21 with a team that were the biggest spenders in the league.
So why did it go so well for him at FC 20 and it went so badly for him at Wolfsburg?
Well, there is a theory, Fred Rutten, who was at 20 before and then it was a nightmare at Schalke, that 20 is one of those clubs where the manager just turns up and coaches a very good team that's been put together by people who know football very well, and that is sort of have a machine type operation that doesn't really matter in the end who's there that much, because the manager itself is only the coach. At Wolfsburg, it's similar, of course, because he wasn't allowed to buy most of the players himself, and he was just supposed to turn up and coach them. The problem is that this is one of the most uncoachable squads in the league. This is a team who are still very much resting on their laurels from 2009 when they won the championship. A lot of players who perhaps overachieved a little bit in that year were put on bigger contracts, lost a bit of the hunger, lost a bit of the determination. There were big arguments with people like Diego, who was signed from Juventus. And they're just very, very tough side to get a grip on. And I think with McLaren, with his coming in and still learning the trade as far as continental management is concerned, and of course getting used to German and to the German culture, just found it very difficult. I'm not sure it reflects that badly on him as a manager. I think it was always going to be a very difficult place to be.
I imagine communication was a problem, wasn't it? If you got a team already there and you've just got to coach them, you'd think you'd want somebody who could speak German coming in to get the best out of them straight away.
Yeah, although...
But his skill with languages, surely that kind of... Yeah.
He did learn German, and his German was pretty good by the time he left. And... most of the players spoke very good English or speak very good English. So I don't think it was really a problem of getting his ideas across language-wise. I think it was more difficult for them to understand what it really was that he wanted from them, because I think he had in his mind initially that he was just going to take the Twente system, 4-2-3-1, and transpose it as best as he could onto Wolfsburg, but Wolfsburg didn't really have the players for it. They had somebody up front, Jack, who was very influential, who always said, I'm much better with two strikers. And they didn't have the wide players. Then he backtracked, and with the consequences of perhaps losing a little bit of his authority, etc., etc. But, you know, even at Wolfsburg, even the fans there, a lot of people are pointing at the general manager, Dieter Hoeneß, who signed Steve McLaren, who signed all these players, and saying, you know, the real blame rests with him. Rather than McLaren.
So all that money they spent with the Dzeko money, that was spent with a future coach in mind?
No, not at all. They spent it hoping that they would spend their way out of trouble, that McLaren can keep the job, because I think any other coach would have already been fired before Christmas. The fact that was him, the fact that Dieter Hoeneß had signed him, actually gave him more credit. And
so why sack him a week after the transfer window closes?
Because they'd had already 3 games, and
just, that's enough. 3 games.
Yeah, just things haven't improved at all. And the real problem is not that, you know, not that they're not winning things or not pushing for the Champions League. They could, Wolfsburg and Volkswagen, who are behind them, would be happy to put up with a season in transition. They wouldn't mind if they're mid-table. The problem is they're in mid-table in 12th position, but only 1 point clear of the relegation. And that is a scenario they cannot contend with, because if they were to go down, it would be an absolute disaster. So that's really what made them now make that move. If he was If he only had 6-7 points more, I think they would have said, OK, we'll give him another year to see what he can really do. But they just couldn't take that risk.
Just the 6 or 7 points more would have perhaps saved him. OK, how's the rest of the Bundesliga? Bayern Munich, where are they? They go up and down, don't they? Where are they? Up at the moment?
Down again. Oh. Fifth now.
Oh. How many points off the top?
They don't even look at the top anymore.
All right. So who's the title race between?
It's between Dortmund and Dortmund,
good.
It's Leverkusen in second place that Bayern want to catch up with.
Right.
Because they need to get into the Champions League. And that's where, again, it becomes dangerous for Louis van Gaal. If he was just second, not being able to catch up with Dortmund, having a reasonable season in the Champions League, they'd say, okay, that's fine. We give them another year. The problem is, as soon as it looks likely that they might miss out on the Champions League, then he's going to lose his job.
Right.
And it is very possible.
Oof, still, because he was under pressure before, wasn't he? They've got a big game coming up next week against Inter. Oh, rematch there against the Italians. If you're curious for a Euro paper roundup of what the continent's top sporting titles have been saying over the last day or two, then do join me on Friday morning for all of the above. Very good. Couple of posts. Cosmic Hobo, one of the many people kindly posting in things we didn't get round to mentioning in Monday's pod, says, no mention of the Connor Wickham wonder goal this weekend, and surely you have an anti-Forest bias. Barely a mention of our rise up the table into second. I bet, Paul, you can tell us all about the Connor Wickham wonder goal.
It was a really, really good goal.
Yeah.
I mean, the little I've seen of Connor Wickham, I thought he's got the strength and the presence. Where was the you know, did he have the technical side? There's a really lovely dribble, a really strong finish. Yeah, it was a very impressive goal. At Forest, as I said last time on the pod, they're on the rise. I think QPR should be looking over their shoulder, even though they're 7 points clear of them. I think it's 5 or 6 wins on the trot. They've got a very good squad. Paul Konchesky at left back. What more could you ask for?
It was the Wickham goal. Was it a Wickham wonder?
It was a Wickham wanderer.
Ah, marvellous. Hagen88 says... It says that Stock Aitken and would have been contrary to what we were saying. There were one or two songs that were worthwhile. They mentioned Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Round, brackets like a record, closed brackets. Fair enough. I wasn't aware of that being a Saw production, but I've always enjoyed that track enormously.
Yes.
Yeah. And he also lists Divine, You Think You're a Man, which certainly has its devotees. And he joins Marcello's Proust, I think it is, in saying a Roblox, but I never liked Roblox. Putative white label thing. Yeah. But there you go, anyway. Stock Aitken and Waterman, Greg.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing. Mm. Right. Coming up this weekend, some big games at top and bottom and in the middle of the Barclays Premier League. We'll be talking about that after this.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
It's a big part three weekend preview, and we're joined for it by Jacob Steinberg, because big games at the top, big games at the bottom, etc. At the bottom, it's last place West Ham at West Brom. Now, this game, and there's plenty to talk about, Chris Hughton apparently joining West Brom. Is that right? Is he taking over as manager? Yeah?
Yeah.
Exciting developments from West Ham's point of view. The fact that they've been named by the people who do the naming as the inheritors of London's Olympic Stadium. West Ham and Spurs both bidding for this venue. Spurs famously wanted to just tear the whole thing down and just build a new one. And why they couldn't just build a new one somewhere else nearby, but I don't understand. West Ham have got it. Jacob, you go to West Ham games. How do you feel about this new stadium as opposed to Upton Park with a running track?
Well, I've never been to a game with a running track.
Really?
Yeah. The closest I can think of is the old Wembley.
Well, that's pretty close.
Yeah. But I was 9 at the time, so it's all a bit of a blur.
Right.
So I can't really tell. I mean, I don't know if anyone else has been.
From Italy, I've spent so many afternoons in stadiums and running tracks. They're rubbish. Yeah. They're rubbish.
Yeah. I mean, what the Stadio Olimpico?
Running track. Awful.
Because Juventus.
I mean, it's beautiful ground, but
Juventus tore theirs down, didn't they?
They changed.
Bayern Munich move, didn't they?
Yeah.
Even Eastlands, that they've removed the running track, and it still seems like an athletic stadium. Still not very good atmosphere. It doesn't seem to take off the way the old main road did.
I can't say on that point because I haven't been to one, but certainly.
But leaving Upton Park behind,
Yeah, but Upton Park has been messed up for years now because because they've moved the there's a kind of running track there, because when they changed the stadium in when they built New West Stand in 2001. They didn't build the other stand alongside it, opposite. So they had to move the pitch away from the small stand, which is opposite the cameras at Upton Park on TV. And so that the pitch now is really far away from it. So the atmosphere just escapes all the time.
All right, so you're not that bothered about leaving Upton Park behind?
Well, certainly it's nostalgic from a nostalgic point of view, but the stadium itself is messed up, sort of like how what happened with Wolves at Molineux.
Good touch, big lad posts in saying, thank God the OPLC has decided to let West Ham try and fill what for them will inevitably turn out to be a white elephant. This may be ultimately because I wanted to see the look on Bongo Merchant's faces, as well as that walking box of unsolicited opinions. Brady, the look on their faces when they have to bring a telescope to watch Championship football in the company of hundreds rather than thousands of fellow punters will be more hilarious. Stills, says good touch, big lad. Do you think that's a slightly pessimistic view, a dyspeptic view of the future?
That's a very pessimistic. That's more pessimistic than I am usually.
Right.
I think that this was what they wanted to do as soon as they got in. Sullivan and goal is to get the Olympic Stadium. It certainly makes West Ham more attractive to potential investors to have this big stadium. It's in a better location. You know, it's right, more or less in the centre. Stratford's an easy place to get to. 60,000 seats. You know, it's be a nice place.
What
to
about
go
stepping
to
on poor old Leighton Orient's toes?
Well, there's a guy who works on the sports desk called Tom Davis who supports Leighton Orient, and he's furious about it.
Furious.
Yeah, he wasn't happy last night.
Right.
I was going to say, when it was first announced that the Olympics was coming to London, I thought they said they were going to build a stadium and then dismantle it and maybe just keep 20,000 seats as a committed athletic stadium. And I just wish they'd have stuck to that idea and not started messing around with football clubs. I just think a sense of place matters more with football and the grounds, and West Ham are a club from West Ham, and you know, they should remain there.
West Ham, and Upton Park isn't in West Ham.
Oh no, but it's in that area. It's not Stratford, is it? You know,
it's ten minutes away.
Oh no, but that's where they, you know, the ground is Upton Park, and I just think they should stay at Upton Park. And building these big bowl stadiums where there's no atmosphere is just ruining football. And sometimes I think anyway, going to watch a match in a good atmosphere, you can accept losing if you've enjoyed yourself. You can go and watch a 1-0 win and sit picking your nose because it just feels like it's an afternoon out at the cinema or something. And
plus one to Greg Roughly. Plus one.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Having said that, I mean, if they do follow through with that promise and make half the stadium available for very little money to people, tickets-wise,
all right,
it could be an amazing atmosphere. If you were to think that this might be the only stadium in the Premier League filled with lots of teenagers.
What they used to do at...
That's a frightening thought. They'd be wearing hoodies and stuff.
Yeah. What they did at Manchester City was, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to sell loads of tickets there through the university.
Right.
Through the Students' Union, which, you know, really cheap, get people in there.
Get the atmosphere going, wouldn't it? Loads of students going to match.
Yeah. All comatose.
With their music and their skinny jeans.
But that's the thing about
they could
the
do the Qatar experience where they just let locals in and deny the ticket holders.
Well, Sullivan Gold won't do that anyway. They'll hike the prices and probably ruin the club. So.
Right.
Well, they said they want to make it much cheaper.
Well, yeah.
But whether they'll be there by then remains to be seen.
Right. And what about the game this weekend? You got off at the bottom of the table last midweek. You dropped
back again.
And now this game at West Brom, good record against the teams at the bottom. West Ham.
Until Sunday.
You think?
Well, no.
Until last Sunday, Demba Ba, Obinna. He's on fire.
Well, he wasn't on Sunday.
No, that's true. He wasn't. they put him back out again. But someone might relight his, week.
What's the explanation for that performance on Sunday? Because, you know, they just appeared to be hitting a little bit of a run of form.
You might have Rafa might have a few things to say about Mr. Rafa. Grant.
Yeah, well, he does. what he doesn't
not, do. Not a fan. Rafael, not a fan.
But let's say, you know, he managed to get to Milan.
Even if you leave Grant out of it, I don't think they were that bad.
On Sunday?
Yeah.
I thought they were dreadful.
Really?
Yeah. As they usually are. They have been
four
times.
I think if they score first, they'd probably win this game.
Well, they've scored first four times against Birmingham, three times, but previously against Birmingham, and each second half he's been found out.
Right. This is against West Brom, though, so maybe that'll make the difference. All right, excellent.
Demba Ba looks very, very good.
Really? Yeah. Well, he only played 10 minutes.
Yeah,
that's the other thing.
His first touch, he hit the... Well, he almost hit the bar. That would have been great.
That's why they call him Demba Ba.
No, but also, the word from the dressing room is that he looks very, very sharp in training.
So, Arsenal-Wolves, glass half full or half empty? They collapsed like big, girly sponges at the weekend, but they are 1 point closer to United, Greg.
Arsenal. Yeah, I think Arsenal will beat Wolves comfortably. And if they've seen that Manchester City have got a result against Man United in the morning or in the early afternoon beforehand, then they'll be even more motivated to go out and beat Wolves. And I think they will do. I think they'll feel like they were hard done by at Newcastle after the sending off.
I think Wolves gave their performance of the season as well on Saturday.
Really?
They were really putting an awful lot of energy into it, and but they can maintain that concentration again. I don't know.
They've had good results against big teams.
They have. They have. They obviously raise it for that in Arsenal, another big team.
I just can't
away
see
from
it.
Home.
I think Arsenal should beat Wolves comfortably, unless United lose to City, in which case they'll completely.
Oh yeah, then they'll just yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Birmingham are taking on Stoke. Your friends Birmingham there. Martins, Obafemi Martins, now his visa's come through, so yet another notch of potency raised there for the Blues. Blackpool, is it six in a row they've lost? Is it?
Five
in a row. And they haven't won at home in five, and they're hosting Aston Villa. Yikes, how's that going to go?
Yeah, that home form has never been all that robust in the Premier League.
It's a spirited performance to put in against Everton. I know they got beat 5-3, but they were going forward and attacking, so maybe they take that into the home game against Villa, give them a game.
5-3 could have been 6-3 with a bit of cleverer refereeing.
Yeah, referees.
You wonder if they're in for a bit of a Hull experience, Blackpool. You hope not, but...
Same colour shirts, kind of, you know.
But they played better football than Hull did during their collapse.
Hull played some good stuff with Giovanni and...
Yeah, originally, but when they were in trouble, they
Hull weren't good.
No, that's the first half of the season when they were 2-0 up against Liverpool.
But when they collapsed, yeah, Blackpool is still playing good football, but just not getting the results anymore.
No, that's...
I would suggest. But we should mention, actually, Blue Chris posting in, wondering why we failed to talk about Everton after their 5-3 win over Blackpool. He said, how many players have scored four in the same game since the Premier League's inception? How many times did the can't score for Toffees last get five in the league? And yet we get the 5-3 against Blackpool, Saha gets four, and all the talk was about other stuff. Fair point.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. They played really well. But I think with Everton more generally, it's a pivotal time for them because I think they just made £22 million losses or £19 million losses, and they had to sell £22 million worth of players to even up the books. Now, going into the future, unless they find investment, then I wonder whether there'll be a situation, if Moyes were to leave, a bit like Charlton and Alan Kirby, and you know, there's a manager there who's very shrewd and has held them together through very hard times financially, and you know, if there was another manager who could come in, then they could really struggle if he didn't work for them straight away.
Bolton against Everton this weekend. Bolton now with Danny Sturridge, who's looked good. Two goals in two games. Jermaine Beckford, though, coming right for Everton, isn't he?
Yeah, they've been using him in the last kind of 10 minutes of games and kind of heaping a load of pressure on him. And then they've started to bring him on a little bit earlier on in the second half, now 65-minute mark. So I think he's been able to give him a little bit more time to make an impact, and he has done as well. So I see that being a draw, Bolton and Everton. They're, you know, see maybe a one-all draw.
You mentioned going into the future. That's something that Karen Brady's been doing, Raphael.
Very interesting piece in The Sun today where it's written from the future, effectively. She writes just after the 2014 World Cup where England under Harry Redknapp have won the trophy, and she welcomes the team back to the opening.
She does.
She does. And she's,
she's still going to be around in 2014. That's the first point.
Football World Cup England are going to win.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Says
it's
Karen Brady
it's a wonderful piece. And it really works on all levels.
Does she mention,
I implore you to read it.
Are there hoverboards in 2014, does she mention?
She doesn't mention them.
Mm. All right, then. So, but why is she writing this?
Well, on the occasion of winning the...
the Olympic Stadium.
The Olympic Stadium.
So
this
basically,
is the inaugural game in 2014.
So Harry Redknapp's bringing the trophy, the World Cup, back to the Olympic Stadium for West Ham fans to enjoy.
For the first game of the season in the new stadium.
Would that be their first game? It'll be just after the World Cup in 2014.
According to the future, yes.
All right.
And the West Ham fans all boo him.
Yeah, West Ham fans hate Harry Redknapp.
Well, if he's got the trophy under his arm,
you
know, they might just
all right,
knight him by then. It'll be Sir Harry.
Yeah. Excellent. And Fulham are playing Chelsea. They have an absolutely rotten record against Chelsea. The perfect opportunity for Chelsea to bounce back from their defeat against Liverpool. Except that Fulham are looking altogether more robust these days.
I think it'll be difficult for Chelsea, especially with the sort of downward... mood they've been affected with. And you know, Ancelotti has lost, someone was saying to me, Ancelotti has now lost seven games.
He's
the
lost
last manager who to lose seven games in the league was, yes,
I don't know, I've
Claudio
got
Ranieri
stat. Oh, was it
Ranieri,
Ranieri,
who was of course fired.
All right, here's another stat. He's now lost more games at home this season than they'd lost in the five previous seasons combined. Chelsea, ouch.
The really interesting thing for me is what Ancelotti will do with the three striker conundrum, because I think for political reasons he played all of them.
Yeah.
It was a disaster against Liverpool, really played into their hands on Sunday, and I think Anelka in that role is really unhappy and doesn't want to be there. So, you know, something will have to give. And that, of course, will have a knock-on effect because Anelka on the bench...
Drogba's never played well with a partner, really, has he? So,
well, I wouldn't go that far, but it's just a formation that doesn't work.
What's Drogba's attitude right now with Torres potentially being a lead striker?
He's going to be at Marseille next season anyway, Drogba, isn't he?
Well,
and I thought they'll sell him and
that's what they keep.
I wonder whether the political pressure is the same on. Is it? I mean, obviously it was big on the Chelsea game. Does Abramovich get involved in games that aren't kind of headline banner games?
No, the thing is, he's been away for many, many weeks, and of course the Torres move was sanctioned by him and very much instigated from the top.
Do you think Ancelotti was happy to have Torres?
I think he would have been happier for another type of players. I think he was very happy with Luis, who was very much his signing. I think Torres was almost a sort of, of course we'll take him, he's a brilliant player,
so but the comparisons might need with Shevchenko and the way he arrived under Mourinho and the unhappiness there, but maybe life in that story. Anyway, you mentioned Spurs before, now level with Chelsea. They're away to Sunderland. Gareth Bale, his back-related injury problems continue, and he's now in doubt for the Champions League next week. So that'll be a difficult game for Spurs, won't it, away at the stadium?
Yeah, they're not quite the same team without him, I think, because on the counter-attack, that is really their main weapon. He's just so brilliant at doing that, especially towards the later stages of the game when games open up and you see, especially the lower teams, don't quite have the fitness to keep it tight for 90 minutes. That's when he comes into his own.
And he said, whisking swiftly along, Liverpool play Wigan and you must be confident of them getting the win there to make it 5 out of 5.
Yeah, and I imagine Liverpool will win that game. Right, Gerrard's supposed to be back as well from this groin injury, in inverted commas.
Did he have a groin injury?
Supposedly,
that's a shame, because it meant he had to miss the England game.
I know, I mean, he'd believe it. And Martin Kelly also pulled out of the England.
Will Suarez start on Saturday, do you think?
Ooh, good question. I think they'll alter the formation to be 3-5-2 rather than this 3-6-1 at Chelsea. And you'll have Suarez and Kout in attack.
Right.
Do you think they'll keep three centre-backs against Wigan at home?
It's not a defensive. It doesn't have to be a defensive formation. This is the thing. I actually think they'll stick with that and go with the three centre backs and push the full backs further forward. So it's essentially an attacking formation.
You can play Poulsen like you play for Denmark and have him dropping into a back three when they're there.
Yes. But meantime, in Manchester,
sorry, Dolesville tactical
Manchester
talk.
United are taking on Manchester City in what they call a derby.
Big call for Bobby Mank, isn't it?
Does he
go for it? Does he go? I mean, you would expect not. But maybe now's the time to declare your intent. Go for the win.
I think you're right. I think this is a moment where they can turn the seat. You know, they could actually maybe get back. They could get back into the title race, and it's a derby as well, isn't it? So I don't think a draw does them any favours.
Someone posting in this week saying Sir Alex, amazing that he once decided to get rid of Piqué and go with Johnny Evans. Hindsight, of course. Real chance then that United's 4-point lead over Arsenal and 5 points over City could be dwindling.
It could be dwindling. And also, if they were to lose, I think psychologically it might be hard for them to recover, because in 2 weeks' time they've got Chelsea away and followed by Liverpool away after that, which could turn the season round completely.
Wow.
If they beat City, it's like a psychological trampoline or something, and they'll bounce on and maybe win that 19th title. So
right.
I should be pointing out that they've won basically every big game they've played this season, and they're brilliant at home.
Yeah,
I think they'll win.
All right then. All right, just saying, you know, just putting the possibility out there.
They're winning the last minute, won't they? As usual.
Very tight. But that is the thing about United. That's what's so amazing about them, is that with a very ordinary team, they are still ploughing on, and that just all tribute to Ferguson.
Very much so. That's it for today's Football Weekly Extra. The weekend awaits. We'll be back on Monday. In the meantime, many thanks to Pascal, to Paul McInnes, to Jacob Steinberg, Raphael Honigstein and Greg Ruffley. And you, the listener, have a super weekend. We'll be back on Monday. Bye-bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.